World-renowned psychologist Steven Pinker does not think that young people are corrupting the English language, but he would like all of us to be better writers. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. In Steven Pinker's latest book, he gives sound advice on writing and tackles a couple of his pet peeves.
We all know the kind of writer who says, well, we had to get the ball rolling in our search for the Holy Grail, but it wasn't a slam dunk or a magic bullet, so we rolled with the punches and let the chips fall where they may.
I'll talk with him about The Sense of Style, The Thinking Person's Guide to Writing in the 21st Century. Then later, Billy Avery on why Black women's health matters. Join the conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. For years, Steven Pinker has been helping us understand our brains, our language, and human nature through his research and through his best-selling books. Books that tackle difficult and fascinating scientific subjects in accessible and lovely prose. Last year, he turned his expertise in linguistics and psychology and his love of good writing into the book The Sense of Style, The Thinking Person's Guide to Writing in the 21st Century. He'll be speaking at the Iowa City Public Library tonight at 7 p.m., an event co-sponsored by Prairie Lights and the University of Iowa Writers Workshop, and he is with me now. Steven Pinker, thank you so much for being here.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Now, you are clearly a man who loves language. You study linguistics. You study how the language we use affects people. You also, in your prologue to this book, you write about your love of style guides. Is this a love affair that's been going on a long time?
Absolutely. Since I was assigned the elements of style by Strunk and White, the iconic style manual of the 20th century. As an undergraduate, I have loved the genre. I admit that makes me unusual.
Do you feel like your writing was influenced by that book and some of the other books that you turned to?
Absolutely. Although this is not true of all writers. And when I sat down to write my own style manual, I began to ask good writers that I knew, including one that I married to, Rebecca Goldstein, which style manuals helped them shape their craft. And I was somewhat humbled when many of them said none. That is, they developed their craft, unlike me, without actually consulting these manuals. And I thought, oh, geez, what am I writing this for? But I like to think that there are some people who do benefit from explicit advice. Many good writers, and this is the way I begin the book, don't so much assimilate a list of do's and don'ts, but they immerse themselves in good writing. They read a lot, and they, I think, mentally take notes, sometimes explicitly, sometimes in just developing an ear as to what good prose is like. And in fact, I begin the book by just encouraging people to stop when they read a passage that pleases them, savor it, and try to reverse engineer what makes it so good. And so I co-opt the experience of people who haven't used style manuals in my own style manual.
Was there something in particular that made you think that now was the time to write your style manual? You write about how so often we hear people saying that, you know, with all of the texting that we do, all of the online chatting, this kind of communication is destroying our language. Was it hearing people say that that made you think, I need to counter that?
Well, yes, because if it was really texting and email and Twitter that was leading to bad language, that must mean that it was much better before digital media. Remember in the 1980s when teenagers used to speak in articulate paragraphs and bureaucrats wrote in plain English?
Of course.
Or was it the 70s or the 60s? So, yes, I've lived through moaning about the imminent decline of the language since I myself first started to write. And historically, you go back and you see that these kinds of lamentations have been around literally for centuries. So everyone always thinks that the language is deteriorating. So it wasn't that I thought, oh, I better step in and save the English language before it deteriorates. The English language doesn't particularly need my help. It'll do just fine. But individual writers, I thought, could benefit from advice on writing that was informed by what we know about language. And all of the classic style guides were written by journalists and writers and novelists who basically were just using their own intuitions, including their own pet peeves, rather than actual knowledge about how language changes, what's the logic of English grammar, how does the human brain process writings, and what makes some kinds of writing easy or hard for the brain to handle. And there were no manuals out there that really took into account what we know about how language works. And so I recognize that as a gap. And the last straw, I mean, I've been thinking about this for many years, that both being a writer and someone who studies language, I could put these two things together. But the last straw was getting back a manuscript that had been worked over by a copy editor who was clearly following rules from some style book like a robot. She was just, the style book said, oh, academics use too many passive voice sentences. They say the study was done instead of I did the study. And so she converted every single passive sentence into an active sentence. And I thought, oh, good. No, this makes things worse. It is true that you should not overuse passives, but that doesn't mean that you should mechanically turn every passive into an active. There are some places where the passive is actually better. And I thought we need a style guide that doesn't give us, lay down a set of laws unthinkingly, but that explains the rationales behind the law so that they can be applied judiciously.
In talking about the fact that we just need to read good writing, we need to read a lot of writing and figure out what we like and what makes it so good. In this day and age, so much of what we read is online. There's this overwhelming amount of content available to read, and a lot of us click through and click through and click through. Do you feel like we need to be mindful in what we read?
Well, yes, but the fact that it's on a screen makes no difference at all. The difference between ink on dead trees and pixels on a screen is not crucial. What is crucial is whether the prose has been edited or at least crafted for some degree of permanence. So, you know, text messages obviously are not a good source of writing because they're not meant to be. They're ephemeral. The comments below the line at the end of an article written by the trolls, you know, that you can ignore altogether. But there's an awful lot of really good writing that is available only on the internet. There are a lot of superbly written blogs. Wikipedia articles are, in general, although not always, but I think surprisingly clear. They are almost always properly punctuated and grammatical. Even Amazon product reviews. There are a lot of bad ones, but considering that no one edits them, that no one gets paid for writing them, they're pretty good. And not to mention all of the books that nowadays are available, both as e-books and as physical books. And, of course, every publication in the world pretty much is available electronically as well as on paper. So I think, you know, don't get hung up on the difference between a screen and paper, but do get hung up on whether the writer has taken care in crafting the prose.
Of course, when I think about things that we read online, Twitter comes to mind, and it's such a short message that you send out to the world when you're using Twitter. Do you feel like that actually can help some writers really hone their craft to need to communicate with such brevity?
Well, you know, Shakespeare said brevity is the soul of wit, and Strunk and White laid down as their first rule of style, omit needless words. A wonderful example of itself, by the way. And so even though Twitter is seldom a model of graceful prose, I have found that being a Twitterer does force you to concentrate on how you can make your communications more succinct. And I think there are skills that you can hone that way. It's a little bit like practicing scales if you're a musician. You don't want to listen to a musician practicing scales as a form of musical entertainment. On the other hand, the practice with scales can then be transferred to more careful kinds of performance. And likewise, the habit of tearing out every needless word in a tweet can then be applied to more relaxed and graceful prose.
In thinking about how people have been complaining forever about the demise of the English language, and I'm sure all other languages probably have these conversations as well, there is an evolution that goes on in our language. And it seems to me that sometimes people get stuck in their little time capsule, and they feel like anything that happened after this point, whether language is evolving or not, it's wrong. And you do see that in so many style guides where it seems to really reflect the times. Was that something that you tried to avoid as you wrote?
Oh, absolutely. Because when you look at the traditional style manuals, you can often be taken aback at the complaints about some form that they... the writers say is trendy or pompous, which today is completely unexceptionable. So, for example, Strunk and White's Elements of Style say never use the verb to contact. It's pompous and trendy. Now, and always be specific. Say you're going to phone someone or you're going to write them. And of course, they didn't live to see email and texting and tweeting and so on and instant messaging. But first of all, they missed the point that sometimes a new word earns its keep because it allows you to express a meaning far more accurately and succinctly than any of the alternatives available. To contact is highly useful when you don't care how one person's going to get in touch with someone else, as long as they do so. I don't care whether you're going to call them or email them or text them, just get in touch with them. There, to contact is the perfect verb. But also, it just happened to be new in their day, in the 1930s. And it came from the world of business, which always taints a new word. You just think of Dilbert or the cubicle farm, and people, especially from with a literary sensibility, are always horrified.
Right, writing mission statements and...
Exactly, yes. I'm going to task you with a deliverable and grow the company and drill down to our core competencies and so on. But sometimes even words that come from the world of business earn their keep. They become a part of the language, and people then forget what the fuss was about. In my case, so yes, of course, I'm likely to be I'm as vulnerable to that as anyone else. But I do have somewhat of an advantage, as I'm chair of the usage panel of the American Heritage Dictionary, which means that I take part in a survey we do every year where we have a list of about 150 writers from all walks of life, sportscasters and professors and op-ed writers and cookbook writers and poets. And we, when they're problematic uses, we poll them. We say, how does this sound to you? And that way we can cultivate an ear for ongoing change. These are not just random people taken off the street, but they're representative of the kind of virtual audience that a careful writer wants to reach. And if their ear is changing, that's a sign that the language is changing.
I'm talking with Steven Pinker. His most recent book is The Sense of Style, The Thinking Person's Guide to Writing in the 21st Century. He'll be speaking tonight at the Iowa City Public Library at 7 p.m. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. My guest is Steven Pinker. He has been writing about science, about language, about human nature for many years. And last year he published The Sense of Style, The Thinking Person's Guide to Writing in the 21st Century. He'll be speaking at the Iowa City Public Library tonight at 7 p.m., an event co-sponsored by Prairie Lights and the University of Iowa Writers Workshop. And we were talking before the break about the evolution of language and how some of these style guides that have been published in the past are really time capsules of some of the things that drove the writers crazy at that time, because things were changing at that time. With the evolution of language, you were talking about changes in the dictionary. Is that a good place to go if you have a question about something. If you're feeling frustrated with a language pet peeve of your own or wondering about, can I use this in this way when I'm writing, is that your go-to source?
Oh, absolutely. Because contrary to what a lot of people believe, dictionaries don't consist of a bunch of lawmakers who decide what is correct or incorrect. It's not like the Rules Committee of Major League Baseball, where if they say it's a rule, then it is a rule. Rather, dictionary editors actually just cultivate an ear for the way the language is used. And when the language changes, the dictionaries reflect that. Now, a lot of purists are incensed when they hear that. They think that dictionaries are falling down on their responsibility to safeguard the language. But there is no such thing as a dictionary that can safeguard the language. Languages refuse to be safeguarded. And any dictionary that did that would soon become obsolete. What dictionaries would be useless. No one would buy them. What dictionaries can do is differentiate the uses that are considered acceptable in formal settings among careful writers and readers from those that are in the language but that you would be well advised to avoid. So I'll give you an example. Irregardless. Now, most careful writers and readers frown on irregardless. It is a portmanteau, a smushing together of irrespective and regardless, and so therefore it's redundant. And most people will tell you, if you want to sound literate, don't use irregardless. Now, some people say, well, irregardless is not a word. Now, that's wrong. It is a word. It's a word that people disapprove of, but it is a word. People use it, and you'll find it in any dictionary. Although a good dictionary will say it's a synonym for regardless, but it is one that is frowned upon. So the dictionary doesn't kind of legislate the language by refusing to include a word that really is a word, but a dictionary will also inform the reader, if you use it, this is what people will think of you, and choose accordingly.
How do you feel about those words where the meaning changes? And decimate is one of those words where, you know, if you look at the literal meaning of the word decimate, it means reduce by a tenth. If you listen to the way people use it in conversation and use it in writing, it means obliterate. How do you feel about those kind of changes?
Well, there's one answer. You have to use the word in the way that people understand it. And if the meaning changes, then you've got to use it. There's no point being a easy minority that is guaranteed to be misunderstood. You really do have to go with the flow. Now, what is the flow? Well, it flows in different ways in different segments of the population. It doesn't mean that you have to write to the lowest common denominator, because if you're writing in an edited publication, if you're writing a restaurant review or an op-ed or a letter to the editor, the people reading it are going to expect the language to be used in certain ways. But those very same people will change their expectations over time. And you have to, if you're a good writer, you've got to anticipate the way your words will be interpreted. And so words like decimate, which virtually no one uses in the original sense, or another example would be the word nauseous. If you're over, probably have to be 80 years old to insist that nauseous must mean nauseating, as opposed to the way everyone interprets it now, which is nauseated. That is, the ride made me nauseous, not he's a nauseous character. There's no point in insisting on an obsolete usage that is going to be guaranteed to make you misunderstood. You really have to cultivate an ear for to language the way it's currently used. That having been said, by the way, also a lot of usage that people think are the original and correct usage turn out not to be the original usage. So, for example, disinterested, which if you're a good writer, you'll reserve disinterested for impartial or having no stake in the matter, rather than it being a synonym for uninterested or bored. On the other hand, it is not true that the original meaning was impartial and that people have been corrupting it. The original meaning was bored. And that is also true of enormity, which purists say should be reserved for great evil as opposed to great size. The original meaning of enormity was, logically enough, great size, just as hilarious and hilarity are related, or curious and curiosity. That was originally true of enormous enormity. So sometimes the more refined usage is actually not a corruption, but is a more recent usage.
Now, there are a lot of people who would say, well, don't use disinterested at all. Why don't you say board if you mean board? We are taught in most of our schools to write in very plain language. And you kind of draw a distinction between plain language and what you call classic prose. Can you help me define those?
Yes, a lot of the traditional manuals advise a style that can be called plain style. Avoid fancy words, avoid unusual words, use the fewest words possible, Strunk and White being an example. They were reactions to some of the very flowery and convoluted language of the 19th century. And it's good that we have gone away from those convoluted and ornate styles. On the other hand, a lot of the fun in writing is coming across unusual words. And if you have to look them up, then that adds to your vocabulary. It increases your expressive power. It's not so terrible if you sometimes send your readers to the dictionary. So I don't take such a puritanical attitude toward language that you always must use the most common word. I think it's good advice to avoid being fancy schmancy or hoity-toity for the sake of it. You're liable to embarrass yourself by misusing a word, and there's no sense in being pompous or pretentious. But sometimes, le mot juste, if I can be excused for borrowing a little fancy French word, the perfect word, the one that captures a shade of meaning that a near synonym doesn't, one that is euphonious in context, it helps the rhythm of the sentence, one that sounds like what it means, like a word like voluptuous or cantankerous, where just hearing the word reminds you of what it refers to. That's what makes writing fun, and there's no reason to tell people to avoid those fancy words.
So how do you define classic prose? Do you know it when you read it?
No. Classic prose, no, it's more specific than that. Classic prose, as defined by Francis Noël Thomas and Mark Turner, is a style in which the underlying model is that language is a window onto the world. Namely, the writer pretends that he has seen something in the world which the reader has not yet noticed. He orients the reader so that she can see it with her own eyes. The style is conversation, and the writer and reader are equals. That is a kind of attitude toward writing that they call classic prose, and it's a kind of pretense. All writing is a kind of pretense because there's no one actually with you in the room as you're putting pen to paper or fingers to keyboard. And the attitude that you take affects the way in which you're going to write. And classic style is one style that I think a lot of us think of as what good, clear, crisp, enjoyable prose. Differs from plain style, which has no sort of subtlety or requires no special discernment on the part of the reader. It differs from self-conscious style, in which the writer is constantly worried about how he or she will look. It differs from contemplative style, where the writer is trying to share his ineffable emotional reactions. Prose that is that tries to point to something in the world and allows the reader to see it with his or her own eyes, that's classic style.
I'm talking with Steven Pinker. He's a professor of psychology at Harvard University, and his most recent book is The Sense of Style, The Thinking Person's Guide to Writing in the 21st Century. And you were talking earlier about how some of those early style guides served to give a platform for the writer's biggest pet peeves. They would focus on the things that really drove them crazy. Did you get an opportunity to air some of your grievances?
Oh, yes. I wasn't going to miss the opportunity to share my peeves. The difference is that I would only indulge my peeves when a majority of the usage panel of the American Heritage Dictionary agreed with me. So it wasn't idiosyncratic to my peeves, but what you should expect an audience of literate readers to, how you should expect them to react.
I got the sense in reading the part that you wrote about avoiding cliches. Is that one of your biggest pet peeves? You seem to have so much fun writing that section.
Yes, we all know the kind of writer who says, well, we had to get the ball rolling in our search for the Holy Grail, but it wasn't a slam dunk or a magic bullet, so we rolled with the punches and let the chips fall where they may while seeing the glasses half full. The problem, and cliches are a sign of careless writing, but the reason that they are is that they violate the principle of classic style, that you're trying to get your reader to see something that you've seen, to see the world. And when you use concrete images like a magic bullet, which you don't actually mean in their literal sense, then the reader is apt to just turn off her visual brain and just kind of process the words as blah, 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 and stop using language as a prod to the visual imagination. And it's writing that keeps the reader seeing things in her mind's eye that we think of as good, vigorous writing. And cliches mean, I better stop even thinking about what these words mean. And of course, if you use cliches, you're also apt to mix your metaphors and to say things like an extract from a New York Times article where someone said, "No one has yet invented a condom that will knock people's socks off." I thought, they really should have thought through that.
No one will invent that, right?
Yeah.
So I want to talk about academic writing, because, of course, that's something that a lot of us have dabbled in. A lot of us do for a living. A lot of us have to read it for a living. And reading an academic paper can be one of the most painful things that I ever have to do. I know a lot of people feel the same way. And you argue that that kind of academic writing that makes me think, I don't even want to turn that page, is unnecessary.
Absolutely, it is. I think there's a systematic reason why so much academic writing is so atrocious. Partly it's because it is almost designed to flout the principles of classic style. Classic style pretends to adopt the philosophy of naive realism. Namely, you open your eyes and you see the world as it truly is. Now, if you're an academic, you're in the business of fighting naive realism. You have to be aware of how difficult it is to attain knowledge, how fragile our knowledge is, how much it can be affected by our biases and our limitations, and how tentative it always is. And so the rules of the game of being an academic and the rules of clear style are almost in direct opposition. As a result, academics write in a highly self-conscious, hedged, tentative style in which they never, ever say what something is. It's always, from this perspective, in the context of that level of analysis, it could be argued that, and then they say what they have to say. In academic writing, you can't pretend that knowledge is easy to acquire, that you open your eyes and you just see the world as it is, because that's not true. On the other hand, you can strategically fake that attitude in constructing your prose so that at least people will know what you're talking about. That is, you don't have to flaunt your epistemological sophistication in every sentence. You don't have to keep saying over and over again, "I know that you can never really be certain about anything and things aren't what they seem," and as a result, just write in convoluted, evasive, hedged fluff. There's an art to using clear prose to express what you want to express and let the reader read between the lines and connect the dots to know that you're not a naive who thinks that you can just see the world by opening your eyes.
There seem to be a few traps that academic writers can fall into, and one of them you call the curse of knowledge, and that is a point where the writer cannot empathize with a reader who doesn't have their same kind of speciality.
People often tell me that the reason that there's so much bad writing is that it's done on purpose. People want to be obscure to hide the fact that they have nothing to say, or they want to impress the reader as to how sophisticated they are. Now, I think that happens sometimes, but I don't think it's the general explanation for bad writing. I think a lot of bad writing is completely innocent. Namely, that people don't know that other people don't know what they know. That is, the curse of knowledge refers to a psychological impairment that we all have to some extent, where when you know something, it's extraordinarily hard to imagine what it's like not to know it. It becomes second nature. It's just the air you breathe. And you don't realize that other people who haven't lived your life need to have the jargon spelled out or the abbreviations spelled out, or they need to have a concrete example. They can't just hear an abstraction like a stimulus or a condition or an instability, kind of airy-fairy words that don't allow the reader to actually visualize something in her mind's eye. We're apt to forget that when we become expert in a subject and baffle our readers because we assume that they know what we know, that they almost as if they have telepathy. I think that's the number one cause of unclear writing.
There's got to be peer pressure, though, as well. When you are a young academic, you're trying to get published, you want to emulate people who've been published before you, right?
That's right. And I think academics have been derelict in holding one another to standards of good, clear writing. I mean, we're supposed to be in the business of disseminating knowledge. How can we do that if no one can understand a word that we say? So I do think that writing should have more emphasis in professional and graduate education, in law schools, in medical schools, in graduate schools, and that also that people be disabused of the myth that journal editors and grant reviewers insist on ponderous language as proof of your seriousness. That is, if someone can understand what I say, they will think that I'm unsophisticated, because how clever could I be if people can understand me? If I want to impress people, I've got to be obscure and mysterious. That, in my experience, that's not true. The journal editors are grateful when they get manuscripts that are that can be understood. And for that matter, you know, when I'm reviewing a manuscript or a grant proposal, I'm grateful if I can just read a sentence and know what it's talking about, instead of having to read it like seven times and then wonder, does the author mean this or does the author mean that? It's a big myth that you've got to write badly to be taken seriously, even in academia.
Steven Pinker, thank you so much for talking with me today.
Thanks for having me.
Steven Pinker, his most recent book is The Sense of Style, The Thinking Person's Guide to Writing in the 21st Century. He'll be speaking at the Iowa City Public Library tonight at 7 p.m. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. For more than 40 years, Billie Avery has been at the forefront of the women's health movement. She's been fighting, advocating, educating, and empowering. She is the founder of the Black Women's Health Imperative, co-founder of Raising Women's Voices for the Healthcare We Need, and a recipient of a MacArthur Foundation Genius Grant. She'll be in Iowa City on October 8th to receive the 2015 Richard and Barbara Hansen Leadership Award. She'll also be giving a lecture called Why Black Women's Health Matters at the University of Iowa College of Public Health that day, and she is with me today. Billie, what a pleasure to speak with you today.
Nice to speak with you, too. What an honor.
I want to go back in time to 1970 when you were a graduate student at the University of Florida. You were the mother of two kids, and your husband, who was only 33 years old at the time, died suddenly of a heart attack. And you cite that terrible loss as the thing that really pushed you into action and activism. Why was that?
Well, first of all, it was a shock, you know, because, you know, we had planned our lives. We were getting ready to go live the American dream. He was about 4 or 5 months from getting his doctorate, and we were ready, you know. We were a young, educated couple, and how could this have happened? We didn't know that high blood pressure was a silent killer, and even though earlier, Wesley had been made aware that he had high blood pressure, but not in a way that it made sense to us or that we knew how serious it was. He was about to be inducted in the Army, and his pressure was high, and they told him to go lay down for 20 minutes, and they took it, and it was normal. And the reason he didn't go is because I was pregnant with our son, Wesley, and threatening a miscarriage, so they called that a hardship. And then one other time before, when he went for a physical before he started a job, they told him his pressure was a little high, but to watch his diet and to exercise. Well, you know what? His pressure stayed high for like 10 solid years between those initial encounters with doctors and when he had the massive heart attack. And I realized that we need to be given health information in a way that it grabs us, that we understand the fullness of what it is. And I just felt so robbed, you know, and my children were robbed of a wonderful father. I was robbed of a husband, all because we didn't have the information given to us in a way that we needed it.
And how did that lead you into the women's health movement?
Well, I was in Gainesville, Florida, which is the place of the rise of the feminist movement. The second wave of the feminist movement started in Gainesville. So it was a town that's very, very politically active, very engaged. I was working at Shands Teaching Hospital on the unit dealing with kids who had autism, the children's mental health unit. And I was surrounded by Paul Adams, who was a Quaker, who was a future thinker, who was a progressive, who really pushed us to think about the future. He said living in the present was boring to him. He loved to live in the future. So he pushed us to think about women's reproductive health, women's rights, and all of those issues that were in the forefront at that time. So I became aware of women's lack of access to abortion, because at that time, women were dying all over the country. Black women, white women were dying from self-induced abortions. And we became interested in reproductive rights. It was just before Roe v. Wade, and it was when the feminist movement was so exciting and taking off, and we were learning all about who we are as women and challenging everything.
Now, in those early days when you were doing this work, you had an encounter with a Black woman who later died of a self-induced abortion. And that was another one of those moments that really galvanized you, really changed your view of what was needed. Can you tell me what happened?
Yeah, it's all about access. What happened is that after Judy Levy and I, who was a psychologist, gave a presentation at one of the didactic clinics, and we sort of became known as women who could help other women get abortions. So when a white woman came to us, we found out how to help her, and we called up and found out about clergy consultation. These were a group of Catholic priests who helped women get safe abortions, and she could go to New York and have a safe abortion. So we gave her these phone numbers, and she was able to do it. So when this Black woman came, okay, we know how to do this. We'll give her the phone numbers and explain to her about clergy consultation in the Women's Health Center in New York, and she can do the same thing. And she looked at me and said, I don't have any way to get to New York. I don't have any money to go. I don't have any money to pay for an abortion. And then weeks later, or maybe like a month or so later, she died from a self-induced abortion. And that's when the access, how important it is to have access. You not only need to have information, you need to have access and sometimes resources.
You also found that when you were organizing meetings and talking to women about their healthcare needs and really leading women to take control of their bodies and their health and understand their bodies, you found that a lot of white women were coming to your meetings, but Black women weren't.
Right. That was the thing. I was a part of an organization called the National Women's Health Network, and we would have all of these programs, and there would be lots of white women there and no Black women, and I kept wondering why. I can't be the only person who cares about them. I'm not saying there would be none. There would be two or three, which, you know, you would expect much more of a critical mass. And so I started to think, well, maybe we need to do something that specifically targets Black women and that says the words Black in it, so that when we hear it, we know it's for us. Because I think the way racism has affected us, when we hear women, we think white women. But when we hear Black women, or Native American women, or Asian women, or Latinas, we know that we are talking about us specifically, and that we then come together to look at ourselves in our ethnic groups.
Now, of course, you were in Florida.
Yes.
Do you feel
like the fact that your meetings basically were segregated, that Black women didn't feel comfortable coming to these meetings, didn't know they were for them. Was this an after effect of segregation in the South, or do you think this was a problem everywhere?
I think it's a problem everywhere. I think that most of the time when we see reports about women, unless they specifically say something about Black women or other women of color, we think it's white women, because a lot of times that's what they base the work on. Just take some of the breast cancer recommendations by the U.S. Task Force that said that women didn't need to get mammograms until they were in their 50s. Well, a lot of Black women will have coming up with breast cancer in their late 30s and in their 40s. You know, my own daughter had black breast cancer in her early, late 30s. So what if she waited until she was 50 to have a mammogram? So you see, you have to not only make these recommendations for the general public, which usually means white people, you have to look at how do they differ for different populations of women.
And when you started really doing research and looking at the challenges that Black women were facing in the 70s when you started this work, you were stunned by what you found. Can you tell us a little bit about what you did find?
Well, actually, I started this particular work with Black women in the 80s. In the 70s, I was working around reproductive health, around birth, and we founded a birthing center as well as an abortion clinic. But in the 80s when we started coming together to look at those issues that were affecting us that had not been reflected in the statistics, and that we were dealing with a lot of issues that that were the effects of racism, sexism, and classism, all those intersections that affect our lives, and dealing with a lot of issues such as not only some physical health issues, but also psychological issues like being victims of domestic violence, being victims of sexual abuse, or rape, and all these things that were happening to all of the women. The white women were talking about them, but the Black women were not. And so our goal was to help us come together in the comfort, in the circles with our sisters, to feel comfortable enough to open up and talk about these issues so that we can learn that this is not just something that happened to Mary, this is not something that happened to Alice, this is an institution that of sexism that needs to be broken down. And so that was a big learning and a big aha for a lot of us.
Now, you have touched so many individuals over the years, and you've inspired so many other people to get involved with your work. When you look around in 2015 and you think about what things were like in the early 1980s, do you feel like Black women in America are better off today?
Oh, absolutely. We are much better off in so many ways. First of all, we know a lot about each other. We know a lot more about each other. We know Black women all over the country. Back in the day, you kind of only knew who was in your town, who was in your small geographic area. But we know a lot more. And I think over the years, we have gained a collective sense of empowerment by having powerful role models break through barriers, and we know that we can do things. Like a lot of the women talk about coming together, talking about the stories of their lives, facing their fears, realizing that sometimes their fears are their greatest sources of power, that we have been able to make gains. And where we are now with the Black Women's Health Imperative is that we are about to stretch out and make different strides and try to set the whole research agenda around Black women's health on its head. We want to change the way that we are being looked at and the way we are being studied.
Explain that to me. What do you want to see happen that will be different?
Well, we have an initiative called Index Us. It's the Imperative Black Women's Health Index. For the last 20 years, the Boston University has conducted a study of 59,000 Black women. They've been doing it since 95. And what we have learned, that what they have studied, is what are the diseases that black women have? Have they changed over this time? What has changed and what has not? What we learn is that not enough has changed. And so for almost 30-some-odd years, we've been talking about the disparities, the inequities, and all of these things about black women. We're tired of talking about that. We want to look at healthy black women and see what works for healthy black women. Like right now, there are about 9 million women in this study that's claimed to be that are healthy. And by the end of 2020, we want to raise that number to 12 million black women. So we want to look at what do healthy black women do. And then from that information, we then can design programs that can deal with structural changes, whatever kind of messaging we need to get to women, how do we need to change the environments of where they live, how do we need to make sure that certain things that are needed to live a healthy life are present, and we want to move it to the positive end rather than looking from the negative end. We really want to lead in having this healthcare help us look at healthcare from a health perspective rather than a sick perspective, like change it from a sick care system to a health care system.
When you look around, clearly you have devoted so much of your life to black women's health.
Mm-hmm.
There are a number of other groups in the United States that also, if you look at the statistics, it's pretty scary, some of the challenges they face. I think about Hispanic women. Do you feel like there are people out there advocating and making a difference for other groups in need?
Oh, absolutely. What happened is one of the things that grew out of the Black Women's Health, when it was called the Black Women's Health Project, we changed our name a few years ago to Black Women's Health Imperative, is that as we started to learn as black women, we brought in our sisters, our Asian sisters, our Latina sisters, our Native American sisters, and we say you have to start looking at your health from the framework of your ethnicity. Ethnicity is important. It is what we share generations through generations, how we eat, how we think, how we see ourselves, how we understand the world around us, and basically how we live in it. And that is crucial.
Do you feel like a woman's ethnicity is still a bigger factor than her socioeconomic conditions?
All of them are together. You know, those intersectionalities, we can't divide them out. Because if I'm discriminated against as a black woman, it hurts me as a woman. It hurts me as a black. It hurts me as this. So we have to have all of those factors. There is no hierarchy of those intersectionalities. They're kind of all are number ones. They're all wrapped up in one body. They're all wrapped up in one soul, wrapped up in one's mind. So we have to really address all of them at the same time.
There have been a lot of items up for debate in the last couple of years on women's health. And right now there's a movement to defund Planned Parenthood underway, which creates a lot of debate over women's access to health care. You have made a lot of positive change in this arena. Do you feel like there is a risk of going backward right now?
Yes, there's always been the risk of going backwards, and there are many of us who said that all the way from the beginning, when Roe v. Wade was put in place, that there was a risk and that we needed to be vigilant, that we needed to not give any ground. But that didn't happen. We gave ground on the Hyde Amendment, and we gave ground, we made concessions in other places, and now we are ending up in a pretty bad place. So we in the reproductive justice movement have to get ourselves together and realize we have to stand firm, and that women need to be in charge of their lives, that families need to be in charge of their child spacing, because at the end of the day, we are expected to take care of our families, and we are expected to do that, and we are always working against the odds.
Billy, thank you so much for talking with me today.
Thank you.
Billy Avery is the founder of the Black Women's Health Imperative and co-founder of Raising Women's Voices for the Healthcare We Need. She'll be in Iowa City on October 8th to receive the 2015 Richard and Barbara Hansen Leadership Award. She'll also be giving a lecture called Why Black Women's Health Matters. I'm Charity Neppe. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.